And the receptionist just says like, oh yeah, you're here about your induction today. And I was like, what?
Welcome to the American Grown Podcast, hosted by Austin Sullivan. The American Grown Podcast will focus on people from different walks of life and their journey to where they are now. Now, turn up your volume and settle in for a great episode.
This is the American Grown Podcast, recorded inside the ColorTech Creative Solutions Studios. Today, we have Gloria Lapp, a certified birth doula. Gloria, welcome to episode 74 of the American Grown Podcast.
Hey, yeah, thanks for having me.
Yes, thank you for coming in. I appreciate it. Let's get like the scoop, because I like to ask new guests, especially people I'm meeting for the first time, how did you originally hear about the American Grown Podcast?
Yeah, I actually was at a party for my five-year-old's friend, and there were a bunch of other parents there, and a couple was there, Grant, and his wife. Oh, what's her name? I forgot again.
Nicole.
Yes. Grant and Nicole with Dude Doula.
They're awesome.
So, yeah, we got to chatting. You know, I told them I was a birth doula and just connected, and then they were on your podcast, I think, shortly after we met.
Okay.
And so they told me about your podcast, and yeah, here I am.
Awesome. Phenomenal. Yeah, the great people. They were episode 54, and they created a literal app that you can purchase in the App Store, I think Android Store as well, called Dude Doula, and it's geared towards the man.
The dudes.
Right? The dudes. Yeah. Right, the dudes out there, yeah, that, you know, need some help figuring out, you know, the birthing process, because it's a big undertaking, right? It's a big change, and we're going to dive into it. But before we do, so there were some interesting facts, two in particular that I pulled out, and both are not related to birth or the birthing process. So the first one being that you have a lot of house plants, I believe over 200.
Yeah, I haven't counted recently. It's probably closer to 300 by now, but yes.
Okay. So when did the love of the house plant start for you?
Well, actually, it unintentionally started before COVID shutdown, actually. I know a lot of people, you know, got into it during COVID or after. But yeah, unintentionally, sort of. I was walking through a Amish greenhouse, and I saw a Monstera. And I about screamed, because I had been seeing them, I don't know, on Instagram or something. And it was this huge Monstera, and it was marked down like 70% for like $13.
Okay.
So back in 2020, it was a pretty good deal. So I got, my husband bought it for me, and ever since collecting them, yeah.
Do you have any the Venus flytraps?
I don't. I think my kids would kill those by poking them so many times.
Oh, yeah. And then it would
close. Yeah,
and
they only close and open so many times before they die.
That makes sense. Yeah, maybe not the best. And on, you have two daughters.
Yep. Yeah, my oldest is 5 and my youngest is just turned 3.
Awesome. Yeah. And my wife and I, some of the listeners know, but there are some new ones. We have two under two, a boy and a girl. So the boy's the youngest. And it is an amazing journey.
Yeah. For my sure. Prayers are with you.
Oh, thanks. Two under two. Yeah, there wasn't a lot of sleep for those first couple months. But it is a lot of fun. So now the second interesting fact, and I just want to throw this out there, and you can explain it better, but pretty much the nitty-gritty, you have a brother-in-law of a brother-in-law, something like that, that is a New York Times bestseller. Tell us a little bit about that, because I just found it very interesting.
Yeah, it is. So Brent Weeks, he is my brother-in-law's brother-in-law. So my sister's husband, his sister, married Brent Weeks. He wasn't published when they got married. You know, that was the whole journey. But yeah, he has a Lightbringer series. He's well known for the Black Prism series. It's all fantasy genre. He's really an amazing writer. And he gifted me, I remember he gifted me a copy of one of his books in German before I flew out to Germany after high school.
Yeah.
And I had 2 years of high school German under my belt. So I was not anywhere close being able to read it. But I did try on the airplane. I remember holding the English next to the German and trying to like decipher. You know, I think I went a chapter and gave up.
Really,
but it was very sweet of him. So yeah, he has really amazing fantasy books. And yeah, it's just a little random fact.
Shout out to Brent Weeks.
Yeah.
So now let's dive in. You kind of are a world traveler. So let's start with your early childhood. You know, where'd you grow up, and tell the listeners a little bit about that.
I was born in Cuenca, South America, in Ecuador. So my parents were actually missionaries for 28 years. They lived in Ecuador for 15 years. They actually translated the whole Bible into a native tribal language called Quechua. So yeah, they moved down there right after they had their first daughter. I am the youngest of four girls.
Okay.
They moved down there and my oldest sister was born, and then I was born 10 years later, and we moved back to the States when I was five. This was before the days of, you know, video calling and phone, like cell phones. It was snail mail. So we didn't really meet our grandparents much. So we moved back to the States when I was five. And we lived in Washington, so we moved out. One of my grandparents lived in Washington, so I think that's why we decided to move there. Yeah, so I mainly grew up in Washington, but I was born for the first 5 years in South America.
When were you in South America?
Oh, I was born in 1992.
1992, okay.
So 5 years, yeah. 1997, we came back to Washington.
You're very young in South America, but what are some of the things you remember, some of the culture there?
Yeah, I mean, I remember just running around playing with, the other Indian kids. And I have an early childhood memory of actually running away from school.
Really?
Like a preschool. I don't know. My mom had put me in there or something. And I had very blonde, like we were called a towhead. So I had white hair when I was little. So all of the Quechua kids loved our blonde hair. So they would kind of circle around us and look at us.
They were infatuated with it.
I don't know. Yeah. So I just remember being sort of freaked out. So when the milkman opened the gates to come deliver milk, I ran out. And it was just down the street, I think.
You didn't get far.
And I ran home and hid. But my mom opened the door to the school teacher, like pounding a lot of breath, like, she ran away. Yeah, so I remember that and just like, asking we had a maid for the first, when I was young. And so I'd ask her, like, quiero manzana, quiero leche. We spoke Spanish.
Okay.
Even though my parents were translating the Bible into Quechua, a lot of people there speak Spanish. So I learned a little bit of Spanish when I was young.
So for fun, like at five, do you remember, like, what would you do? Because, you know, like you said, there's no, this is way before iPhones, you know, before screens. I mean, computers were.
Imagine,
wow. Right. Yeah.
We just played outside.
Yeah.
Honestly, we'd had like, I remember we had a funeral for a bee once. We had a pet bee, my sisters and I, and then it died. And so we hosted this whole funeral for the bee.
Yeah.
My sisters set out chairs. We made lemonade. And
this was legit.
Yeah. We were devastated that our pet bee died. So yeah, we just, had a childhood, honestly.
And one of the interesting facts you put on the form was that you've eaten guinea pig. And I wasn't sure if we're going to bring it up or not, but, then I said I didn't know, but I guess it is kind of like a delicacy thing down there. It's a norm.
Yeah. I'd say it's, probably equivalent to us just like eating bacon. Yeah, it is a common staple. A lot of Quechuas will have guinea pigs just running around their house as pets, and then, they get big enough and cook them up like a chicken.
Okay. And what do they taste like? Do they taste like bacon or like a chicken?
I think it's been a long time since I've had one.
That's true.
I don't know that I would do that here. But sort of, they're, depending how you cook it, sometimes it can be pretty tough and greasy, kind of like jerky, but I think it has sort of a chicken taste,
okay.
I guess.
Yeah, that's what I picture.
Uh-oh.
I don't know.
It's a little different.
It is. It's very different. It's unique.
There's different types of guinea pigs. They're not like the little tiny hand size guinea pigs.
Don't
that you
go
see
to your
the
pet store to buy
There's
these,
not much meat on those.
Yeah. Gotcha. Okay.
These guinea pigs, they're like mini pigs, but they're fluffy and furry.
Okay.
So
they're
are cute.
Pigs are
But they're
cute
still
too,
pigs.
Yeah. Gotcha. So. Okay. So you move to Harrisburg. Of all places, because of family?
No, actually, I knew no one out here when I moved. So I grew up in Washington State. And after high school, I didn't really know what I wanted to do with my life at 17. The thought of going $10,000, $20,000, $30,000, $100,000 in debt for education, like college, didn't appeal to me when I didn't know what I wanted to do. So I decided to do a discipleship training school with Youth with a Mission. It's a Christian organization for, youth. Okay. Gets them out on the mission field. It's really great. So I ended up going to Germany at 17. And yeah, my parents shipped me off. I didn't know much German, probably the equivalent of like a two-year-old German kid is the amount I knew. And yeah, my DTS was there for 6 months. And then we went to Bangladesh and India for 3 months. And then after that, I, again, didn't really know what I wanted to do still. So moved back home with my parents, which after a year living abroad is, you know.
Yeah.
It is what it is. So, but I did community college, got an associate's of arts in graphic design and photography because I'm artistic and I knew I liked doing those from high school and I did it in YWAM a bit. So, yeah, so I got an associate of arts in that. And then again, after getting that degree, I still didn't really know what I wanted to do. So a friend, one of my old pastor, knew someone out in Harrisburg who had a ministry. And they were like, well, maybe you can go out and visit and, you know, intern for them or something. So I came out and did like a 3-week worship school up at Life Center Church in Harrisburg.
Okay, I think I know back where that is.
This was in 2013.
Is that what's over there? I know there's a Sheet.
It's near Chick-fil-A, Target, sort of on the other side of the highway.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of like up on the hill.
Up on the hill,
It's up on the hill. Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. I know about where you're at.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Small
world. It's our church now, too. So it's sort of been a part of my story ever since I moved to Harrisburg, which is cool.
And to go back a little bit, isn't it crazy at like, 17, 18, to ask a kid like, okay, what do you want to do? And you're going to spend this much money. Like, talk about that for a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, all my older sisters, I felt like kind of had their stuff together. We were all very good in school. And, you know, my first sister's a teacher. My other sister became a nurse. The other one went for architecture. Okay. I just never really had... a strong passion about something that I felt was worth going into that amount of debt for at 17, when you don't know what you like, really.
Yeah.
You don't know that at that age, so.
No, 100%. And I just think it's a wild concept that...
go out and see the world, like experience. Yeah. And don't see the world in like the sense that people do nowadays. Like I feel like young kids are like, I just want to travel. It's Airbnbs in like Greece, right?
Yeah.
Like... I really think there's huge value in sending your kids on some sort of missions trip or something to a part of the world where like it really will open their eyes and show them like they're not the center of the world. There are people out there a lot less privileged than you. What can you do to contribute goodness to this world? What can you do?
100%.
It really kind of shows you how big the world is and how small you are, and it just
it's eye-opening.
Yeah,
I'd imagine.
It is, yeah.
And it's more of an experience than just getting an Airbnb, you know, and we went to these parties or whatever,
taking photos for Instagram.
For the gram, exactly. It's it's more experiencing, right?
Cultures.
Exactly. Because I remember in high school, that was the big push. It was, 4 years, get in debt. And it's like, I don't even know what I want to do. And even, I think, in your late 20s, you're still trying to figure out what exactly you want to do and be. Wow. So you've been all over. I mean, then you go to Germany, Bangladesh, India. Mm-hmm. What were some of those, like, experiences like? Mm-hmm. And what did you, like, learn and take away?
You know, being a missionary kid, I don't think... I was already a little bit adjusted. We went down to South America again when I was 13. So I had already traveled quite a bit for a 17-year-old, but it still is a different level when you see different levels of poverty. It changes you. So I think it definitely changed me and made me realize like, okay, I, you know, want to do something to bring goodness into the world. And like, even now, like I'm still, 13 years later, I'm still like in my head dreaming of like, okay, maybe someday I can like go overseas and be a midwife and, you know, help women in areas where there's no maternity care like that. So like, that's still a far off dream for me because, I have my own kids now. So there's that element. But it's really, it's just a perspective shift. But you see some... you see some crazy things when you go to places like that and just sort of submerge yourself in their culture instead of, you know, trying to find the best cool new spot.
Right, to take pictures yeah, for the gram.
For sure.
Do you remember, is there a certain story or moment mm-hmm. that stuck out to you, positive or negative, about the experience? Like something that you take with you to this day?
Yeah, you know, I think one of the things we did, we worked with some orphanages, and then we also just, like, you know, went and hung out in a lot of, like, the slums along the train tracks.
Yeah.
And I think one thing I really remember was we found a woman to agree to, like, make dinner with us. So, like, we went out and got, you know, the rice and the vegetables, and we bought all the supplies, and she was like, yeah, I'll cook you dinner. So she had us in her home, and she yeah. cooked dinner for us, and she had maybe like a 6-month-old baby and like another kiddo. And, you know, these kids are like, it's the slums. So, and they're all just sharing like one bed and one quote room, which is more of like just a tarp over some garbage piles, essentially. So yeah, we had dinner with her, and just like her warmth and generosity in her lack was pretty profound. And also just like the looks we got, because it was well known that she was like a lady of the night in the area.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
People were kind of like, what are these kids doing? Yeah. Why are they hanging out with her? And so it was really cool. Eventually, like a lot of the community around there, they all kind of came, and we, yeah, just kind of hung out and played with the kids, played games with them. And yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that really does put into perspective, mm-hmm. you know, life and how fortunate, you know, we are. Now everyone has a different path, a different right. story, but wow, it's blows your mind to think mm-hmm. that people are living that day in and day out. I mean, mm-hmm. that meal that you made with her was probably the only meal I had that month, you know, really, mm-hmm. you know, yeah. Wow.
And she didn't have to work for it either.
So. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And it's nice that, like you said, the community came together mm-hmm. to enjoy a moment or break bread, whatever it mm-hmm. may have been. But, gosh, and this is all at 17, you're doing this.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I feel like a lot of 17-year-olds, at least here in America, you're, right. you know, playing games or worried about, you know, your hair. How mm-hmm. do I look, like you said, for Instagram right. or whatever it might have been. Wow. So then moving
fast forward, yeah.
Yeah, fast forward a little bit, right. Being in Harrisburg. Mm-hmm. Yeah, take us through that whole process of traveling the world, and now, boom, Harrisburg.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, why Harrisburg, right?
Why Harrisburg?
I got that question a lot.
Yeah.
It was actually between Harrisburg and Lakeside, Montana.
Wow.
So people often ask that question even more when I say those, you know, two options.
Those two, yeah.
I don't really know. I came out for the worship school in Harrisburg. Yeah, it was between those two places. And yeah, I just love the community. So it's actually a ministry, cool ministry out in Harrisburg now. I was there at the beginning, but it's called Love the Hill. Tannen and Christina Herman run it. They've gotten federal grants to like help the community neighborhood. It's amazing. Anyway, so I was there like sort of at the beginning of that, and I did the worship school, and then I decided to just move out to Harrisburg. I didn't really know many people. I just knew that I was going to come and live at the mansion, is what they called it. It's this big house on South 13th Street in Harrisburg.
Okay.
So it's sort of in not so great part of the city at that point. It's a lot better now than it was 10 years ago.
Okay.
It's honestly a large part because of Love the Hill. They're doing great work. So yeah, so I moved there it was sort of on a whim, honestly.
Yeah.
So I came out and started serving for a ministry called Burn 24/7. And eventually I ended up meeting my now husband. He lived in Lancaster and I lived in Harrisburg. So it was a lot of
driving
back and forth.
And you said it right. I didn't mean to cut you off, but you said Lancaster.
Yes.
Okay, because people normally from out of the area.
Lancaster.
Like, yes, Lancaster. And it's like, no, it's Lancaster.
Yes.
Oh, good. Okay, I'm sorry to cut you off.
You're
good. So you meet your husband from mm-hmm. Lancaster. How did you two meet? And take us from there.
It's a long story. The short version is friends. I met people at the worship school who lived in the same apartment building that he lived in, and I went to hang out with them one day, and he came back for lunch during a conference, and I was sitting on his couch, and he was just like, whoa, who is this girl in a bright blue dress sitting on my couch. So that's when we met. And then that was right before I came back actually to Washington, before I moved out. That was during the worship school. And he proceeded to find me on Instagram and like every single one of my photos.
Oh, no.
Back to the beginning.
No. Oh, wow. So he's creeping a little bit.
And
know.
I oddly didn't think it was creepy. I don't know at the time. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, it says that he's really into you, right?
And, I guess.
You know, yeah. Did he have a long beard like he does now?
It was smaller. Yeah, it was smaller.
Still had a beard, yeah.
Yeah, still had a beard.
So he likes your social media. He's just going off on social media.
Yeah.
So then did you message him or did he message you?
Well, so then I moved out. We actually didn't meet again until probably a month after I had moved out. We bumped into each other at Life Center Church in Harrisburg. He went up for a Wednesday night session and I was there. And he was like, hey, we should get together. And like you should bring some friends to Lancaster and we can hang out. And then none of my friends could make it and none of his friends could make it. Oh. So then it was just us.
It became a date. Yeah, yeah.
And we did that for probably a month before he told me that he liked me.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, that was a funny season.
Isn't it like everything happens for a reason, you know? Because you didn't know. Yeah, there you are with friends on his couch.
Yeah.
He comes in from work. It's like, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
It amazes me how things just align. Mm-hmm. You know, the stars align.
We got married. Yeah. Fast forward all that. It's not important. Yeah, no, okay, it is.
Yeah. We
dated for 9 months and then we were engaged for a year actually. And we got married. I planned my wedding cross continent. We got married in Washington. So we got married at my uncle's house, like on his property and in front of his house.
Yeah.
The mountains at the backdrop. It was
Washington.
Gorgeous.
I've never been out there,
it was a perfect day, like 70 degrees, gorgeous. So yeah, we got married out there. And then moving towards the topic that I'm passionate about, which is birth. We're both the youngest of our siblings, and so we already have tons of nieces and nephews. So we wanted to start having kids a couple years into our marriage, and I think it had been a year, and I still hadn't been able to get pregnant. And so I went to the doctor, and they told me, you have PCOS, which is polycystic ovarian syndrome.
Okay.
It's actually the number one reason for infertility in women. It's pretty common. I think it's 6 to 12% of women suffer with PCOS, and some probably don't even know it. So I'm pretty passionate about educating women and even just like, you know, their spouses. Like if you're a husband and you have a wife who's suffering from really intense cramps or irregular periods and she doesn't know what's wrong, there could be something, you know, wrong, and it could be PCOS. And it's not her fault necessarily. A lot of times blame is cast on women, especially for something like PCOS. Pretty much what women are told is to lose weight and eat better.
Really? That's supposed to solve it.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
There are ways to naturally heal PCOS. Like, yeah, it's always good to eat healthy. But like, honestly, I think there's so many other factors that play into it, you know, like our environment and the hormone altering products we put on ourselves. Like there's just too many things to just blame it on women's diets. And I know women who have had undiagnosed PCOS for years because they were fit. They were healthy.
Really?
And they still weren't able to get pregnant. And so, you know, practitioners just assumed like, well, you're in shape. You don't have PCOS, and blew them off. And, you know, it turns out years down the road, it's like, wait, you actually do. So genetics probably plays a factor in it. It's just, so it's not her fault necessarily, but there are things you can do to help heal it. So I got the diagnosis, and it took 2 years for us to conceive our first. Yeah, so I am pretty passionate about fertility and education on that.
Like I was mentioning, I mean, how frustrating, because that's the last thing you want to hear. Oh, yeah, you need to lose weight and watch your diet. It's like, really? That's what we're going to blame this on right now, you know?
Yeah.
Your birthing experience, you know, walk us through then, you know, like you said, you tried 2 years, got pregnant with your first.
So my first, I had a normal pregnancy, healthy, nothing shocking, nothing goes wrong, right? Then I go to my 40-week ultrasound, and the ultrasound techs aren't allowed to like say anything, right? So she just gets really quiet, and I get, my mom's with me. We both got concerned because she was acting like something was wrong. She came back and said like, well, the OB wants to talk to you at their office and discuss the results.
Oh,
so,
Lord. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So my heart's like racing. So it's a 5-minute drive from, you know, where I got the ultrasound to the office. So then I walk in and I tell them my name, and the receptionist just says like, oh yeah, you're here about your induction today. And I was like,
what?
What? No, I'm just here to discuss the ultrasound I just had. I had known nothing. I didn't catch it at the time. Okay. I was so naive and like, I didn't know. But I think after I had my baby, I realized, it dawned on me, that they had scheduled my induction in the 5 minutes it took me to drive from my ultrasound to their office before they had even told me what was
consulting
wrong.
Consulting with you, the mother, the mom-to-be. Yeah. Holy cow.
So I had an NST, which is a non-stress test. They hook up
those monitors
to your belly. Yeah. And yeah, they track baby's movement and heart rate over like 20, 30 minutes.
Yeah. Was yours like pink and blue? And I'm sorry.
Yeah.
So. Okay. But anyway, I'm sorry. Continue, please.
No, you're good. So yeah, they want to make sure, you know, baby's moving enough times per minute, their heart rate's good, that they're not stressed out and they're healthy, right? So my non-stress test was fine. You know, baby was fine. But the OB still burst through the door and just says, well, are you ready to have baby? And I was like, I was 40 weeks and 2 days. So just past my due date.
Okay.
And I was like, I mean, yeah. What do you mean? And she was just like, well, your amniotic fluid levels were pretty low, so it just means like that we should start this process and you should have your baby. I was very naive. I knew nothing. I was kind of the mind of like, stick my head in the sand so that I'm not afraid, and my body will figure it out when it needs to, you know, like I'll just have this baby like women do every day.
Yeah.
So I didn't know much. I took the hospital birth class that they recommend, right?
We did that too. Yeah. Because you think, it'll help. Yeah.
Right.
It'll prepare you. Yeah.
So I was just trusting, right? So I was like, oh, okay. Yeah, sure. There was not a discussion of what are the risks of induction? What are like my risks of staying pregnant? I legit asked at my 6 week postpartum appointment why I was induced. I did not fully understand why I was induced after I had my baby. 6 weeks postpartum in the depths of depression, I asked my baby wife, like, I don't understand why I was induced in the first place. So with low fluid levels, they're afraid of a stillbirth, right? So,
okay.
I mean, obviously no one wants that. But like, there are different things, options you can do. And so for me, and in counsel, like consultations with other obstetricians, and looking up my medical records 5 years afterwards, I really believe like my induction wasn't necessarily urgent. Maybe I didn't need to have it done that day. Yeah. Maybe I could have done some sort of expectant management, went home, put my feet up, drink a lot of water. You know, a mom's water intake really sort of reflects how much fluid levels she has. So none of that was offered. It was just like, okay, go to the hospital at 4 p.m. This was at like 11. So in 5 hours, come to the hospital, you'll have your baby. I was like, okay, cool. Yeah,
so like, but to back it up a little bit, you know, you and your mom are going for like the ultrasound, just a checkup, right? Just to see if everything's good.
Yeah, 40 weeks, yeah.
Yeah, 40 weeks, right. Yep. And then all of a sudden, boom, the OB wants to see you, right? Mm-hmm. I'm using proper terms. I went with my wife for some things, and I feel there's not much that you can do to help, right, in the moment. Like, you're there. Mm-hmm. But it's your wife. Like, you can't take that pain away. You know, and it's just, it's very overwhelming, you know, especially your first. After your first, you learn so much. But so anyway, they pretty much surprise it on you and your mom. And they're just like, boom, we're having this baby.
Well, what it was is I was below a threshold. Okay. So like they're going to have a threshold. So maybe it's 5 centimeters of amniotic fluid levels, right? Yeah, yeah. If you have less than 5 centimeters, they have some sort of threshold protocol, standard operating procedure, where they're like, okay, if it's below this, you should induce, right? And so I was 40 weeks, you know, you should induce. So I didn't, you know, my baby was not engaged, wasn't in my pelvis. Like, I knew nothing about what to do during pregnancy to help engage the baby. Like, I was literally like sitting on my back for a lot of my pregnancy.
Oh, yeah.
And just like, I knew nothing about that. And my husband and I go into this induction knowing nothing. Just sort of at the mercy of the system. And so I was, you know, given Cervidil, which is a sort of tampon-like hormone-coated thing they put on your cervix, and some Ambien, and told to try to sleep in a hospital bed at 5 p.m. So
yeah.
Meanwhile, like, the woman in the room next to me was screaming and wailing.
Oh, no.
And And I was like, oh boy, that's going to be me. So started out just nervous and fearful and all those great things. Then like the next day, I was only maybe 2 centimeters. And by probably 10 a.m., I was still 2 centimeters. And like, so I hadn't progressed, right, in like 4 hours. So then they were like, all right, well, next we're going to break your water at 2 centimeters.
They should wait.
Anybody who knows anything knows that like as soon as you break your water.
It's a timer, right?
It's a timer, yes. And if you break your water before you're at a certain dilation, your chance of a C-section like goes through the roof. Like it's astronomically high.
Yeah.
So yeah, they break my water and it's ironic because I was there for low fluid levels and like literally the second method of induction they did was to get rid of all my water.
That doesn't make sense. That doesn't make sense at all.
So, and my body was clearly not doing much. So I labored. Yeah. I got an epidural at some point. I was still at 2 centimeters and I labored for 38 hours. And only got to 2 centimeters.
Oh my lord!
Whole time.
That's brutal, and it's your first.
And it was my first.
And
yeah.
And it, what's your husband's name, real quick?
Justin.
Justin, shout out to Justin. Yeah. So I mean, he comes home from work, I'm guessing, because you break the news to him, like, hey, we're going in right now to have an induction.
Yeah, I called him after it was like noon. I called him, and it was like, hey, so he came. He got off work, and we went back to our house, packed up our bags, and like. Tried to sleep. We laid in bed. He slept and I just laid there like wide awake.
Right. Well, yeah.
Yeah. And then we went to the hospital. So yeah, it was same day sort of situation. And then 2 days later.
Yeah.
And please. I also had no idea how long induction to take when I went in and the nurse was like, well, like you're ready to have your baby in like 2-3 days. I was like, what do you mean 2-3 days? Like I didn't know inductions can take 2 or 3 days sometimes.
Right, right.
So,
wow. Yeah. All right. Let's take a sip break real quick.
So it was a C-section. It was like 1 a.m. I was 2 centimeters. For about 2 hours, my daughter's heart rate was falling like pretty low with each contraction. I had those monitors on because I had an epidural. And her heart rate just wasn't recovering well. So the OB came in at like 1 a.m. to consult. And, you know, he said like, you're still at 2 centimeters. It's been 38 hours. I was exhausted. I had also gotten IV pain meds, which I definitely advise against. They just make you very loopy. It's essentially fentanyl.
Oh, yeah, nice.
So
that's good.
I was high as a kite.
Yeah.
Don't recommend those. So yeah. And then like while he was there, you know, saying like, you know, maybe we can keep trying this. We can keep turning you to try and get her heart rate back up with every contraction. Like my daughter's heart rate dipped to like 50 and all these alarms and whistles start going off beeping. And I was so out of it that when the doctor was like, okay, like, you know, your baby needs to be born now. He was like, I'm going to make a bikini line. And I was so out of it that I looked at him and I was like, like a wax?
Like a wax?
I thought he was going to give me a bikini wax.
What are you talking about, Doc? Yeah. Yeah, because you're on all these drugs for pain.
And he laughed and he was just like, no, sweetheart, that's where I'm going to cut you open. Ooh, and I just started bawling because it was not on my radar anywhere the whole time throughout my labor. Like, C-section was so far from my mind. I just thought I knew so little about birth. I just thought like, okay, this Pitocin and whatever,
Pitocin.
It's going to push my baby down and it's going to come out. It's going to be great. I didn't know. So, I was rushed off for a slightly emergent C-section and could feel a lot of it because it was just an epidural. And so I came out the other side pretty traumatized, postpartum depression, PTSD symptoms, nightmares, lack of bonding with my new baby, lots of issues.
Yeah. And if you don't mind, I definitely want to talk about that because I feel like it could help a lot of listeners. But to back up, did they ever try to do the balloon tactic? I forget
balloon
what it's
catheter.
Called. Yes.
They did not try that on me. I'm not sure why.
You think they would before they
break?
You know?
I know. Yeah. I'm confused too.
Like take every step before. And the reason I bring it up, so my wife and I guess we're very fortunate. Parker, our daughter, and Finn, our son, came very quickly, natural childbirth.
Wow,
she didn't even do an epidural, which was my wife's amazing. Women are so much stronger than men. 100%. They are like the backbone of society and humanity in general.
Keep
women.
Humanity going.
They do. Yes. And they need all the credit for it. But the second with Finn, they wanted to do, because her dilation was slower. But needless to say, they wanted to do the balloon and we were against it. So the doctor comes in, hey, we're going to do the balloon. And I was at this point, because you almost have to, what's the word I'm looking for? Like speak up, speak for yourself.
Advocate.
Amen. Thank yes. you. Knuckles on that. Thank you. Advocate. That's exactly
so
what
you advocated for.
Yes. Way and I go. Said, Doc, I said, because this is a doctor, older guy, tall, yeah. you know, and I said, no, dominant. Doc, we're not. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I said, we're not. No, my wife does not want to do that. And she said, yeah, we never agreed to that. You know, you said for us to talk and we'd let you know.
Oh, I have chills. Way yeah. to go.
Thank you. Thank you. I mean,
you're her Superman.
I felt like her knight in shining armor that time because he was dead set on doing it. And we both agreed, no, we don't want to do it. So I you know, spoke up and he's like, well, I guess I just, and I said assumed. And right. he's like, yeah. Yep. And then he walked off. And then, you know, a few hours later, everything worked out. But
yeah.
That just drives me nuts that they went, broke your water, you're only dilated 2 centimeters, and then, you know, you're in labor all that time. Mm-hmm. I mean, it escalated for you so quickly for you and Justin. So I've heard from other friends and people I know that they've had the C-section and they have, they feel it. And walk us through that. And, and of course, the depression that follows with it. I think a lot of women suffer from it and maybe even, fathers, you know, in their own way, but talk about that because I feel like more people should talk about it and the help they get and the people they talk to.
Yeah, like with C-sections, so often if you're already in labor, I already had an epidural placed for my labor, so they just went with that for the C-section, and that's just a continuous stream of medication into your spine to like numb you from the waist down, right? Oftentimes women actually don't even know when they're planning their birth that sometimes epidurals aren't even effective. Sometimes your epidural can fail, or you can get a window where it's like the medication isn't quite getting to the right spot. And so you have like this patch in your belly where you have feeling, right? So that's sort of what I had right in my lower right pelvic area where they cut me open was a window.
Yeah.
So that's what epidurals do with like planned C-sections. It's like it's called a spinal block, and that's just a one-time injection into your spine, and then it like immediately numbs you from more like the chest down. With my second baby was also a C-section. I was numb like from my armpits down.
Wow.
When I had her, it's more effective. It was less traumatizing because you don't feel the tugging and pulling and anything. But going back to like your questions, after a woman has a C-section, there's a lot of physical damage, obviously, and just recovery that needs to happen. And also mental and emotional and spiritual, all of the things. Oftentimes, if, you know, a woman has a unplanned cesarean, there will be some level of postpartum mood disorder attached to that. So I think it's really important for partners to be able to recognize those things. My husband actually sent me back in to my doctor after my 6-week appointment, I think, or I think it was maybe 3 months after I had my baby. I don't know. He sent me back in again because I was too afraid to talk to them at the first appointment I was at. He asked me to go back in again to talk about my birth and postpartum stuff. And they ended up putting me on medication, which helps sometimes. Yeah, there's only so much like mental work you can do or like encouraging words that partners can speak. Like, it is a chemical imbalance in a woman's brain that can occur in postpartum. All those hormones are just dumping and falling after birth. And then the demands of taking care of a newborn, and maybe it's not what you expected it was, and your body feels broken. You can barely put on your own pants. Like, it's just rough. For partners to be able to recognize those signs is important. And so he sent me back in. I did get on medication, which helped. It levels things out. So I didn't have as low of lows. I wouldn't just burst into tears and crying all day. But I also didn't have very many highs either. It just sort of made me apathetic about life in general. Mm-hmm. So eventually I was able to wean off of them, which was good for me. But yeah, it took a solid year. I mean, I think it's taken 5 years to process my first birth.
Yeah.
It's what's set me on this journey, honestly. And my second birth, actually, more so than my first, because after my first, I was set on this VBAC journey, which VBAC stands for vaginal birth after cesarean. I think, something that people, often say is, you know, just be thankful you have a healthy baby, or like all that matters is a healthy baby, right?
Yeah.
It's just a very problematic phrase that people say when they're uncomfortable with a woman's like brokenness. Like if a woman expresses any sort of dissatisfaction over her experience or anything, oftentimes it's, oh, well, you know, at least you have a healthy baby, or like all that really matters is a healthy baby, which that's not that all that matters, because you can't have a healthy baby if you have a depressed mother. You can't have a healthy family unit if you have a mother who's on the brink of postpartum rage. And if a mother is in depression, is steeped in postpartum depression, her partner, the father, is at a higher risk for being depressed. So like you can't have a truly healthy family if you don't have a mother who's taken care of and healthy, like mentally as well. So I think that's really important.
Like I said earlier, the, you know, moms are the backbone of society, and definitely the family, you know, and you know, you get through it together. But yeah, I mean, I think, you know, for any guys listening, it's an experience, and it's okay to cry and be there for your wife, you know, because she's going through things that you have no idea as a guy. You just don't. And go the extra mile for her, because, you know, well, what she's been through, you know, you'll never have a concept of what it is. But yeah, so what are some of the like misconceptions that society has about VBAC?
Yeah, vaginal birth after cesarean. So yeah, a big problem I think in our country is obviously our C-section rate in our maternity system is the C-section rate, and it ends up putting a lot of women in the situation of having a primary cesarean, which is when your first child is born by C-section. You've never had a vaginal delivery. So when you are going to have your second child, there's so many things that, you know, doctors and people will tell you, you know, like you should space your babies out so you're, you know, you're healthier, you have time to recover. Oftentimes that's easy to do because, you know, with my first, I was reeling from depression and trauma, and it took me a while to heal from that. So we didn't conceive our second till I was 17 months postpartum, which is like a good spacing, we felt. From like a public society standpoint, oftentimes people maybe view it as risky or dangerous or selfish. Even oftentimes misconceptions or like practitioners' beliefs could be that, yeah, C-section carries risks that aren't worth having a quote experience, right? So some people think it's, oh, they just want the experience of having a baby vaginally, right?
Yeah.
Whereas it's so much more than just an experience. Like, yes, it can be an opportunity for like massive healing and redemption for moms, but also physically avoiding massive surgery and the recovery from that, avoiding lifelong implications of multiple cesareans. So many reasons why trying for a VBAC is healthy for you and baby. You know, baby receives a lot of microbiome as it passes through the vaginal canal that it doesn't with having a C-section, and just the lifelong implications and health implications for your babies being born vaginally. Like, there's so many reasons why women might want it. So, yeah, I think it's funny because oftentimes people see it as like this big scary thing, or at least with practitioners, it can be hard to find ones who are really supportive, but it's really just, it's a vaginal birth with a slightly increased risk of uterine rupture. It's, the risk of uterine rupture is actually quite relative to other risks in normal pregnancies, like shoulder dysgocia, which is when baby's shoulder gets stuck behind the pubic bone as it's being born. There's a low risk of that happening in any birth. And it's about the same as a uterine rupture with a vaginal delivery.
Oh, wow.
Yet with VBAC, they're like, oh my goodness, you have this risk of uterine rupture happening and your baby could die and blah, 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 right? So you should just schedule another C-section. You should just have another surgery.
Yeah, which yeah, that's what we've heard. It's like, oh, once you have your first C-section, it's like every baby after that, oh, you just have another C-section. Just have another C-section. Yeah.
Yeah, that used to be a mantra, once a C-section, always a C-section. I think back in like the 80s or 90s. The 90s, VBAC started to like come up with a vengeance. But then, you know, they started seeing uterine ruptures. And so that's when a lot of like studies and publications came out. But the reason a lot of those ruptures were happening were because practitioners were liberally like inducing these VBAC moms. And when you induce, it does increase the risk of uterine rupture. And so if you go into labor spontaneously with a VBAC, your risk of rupture is a lot lower I like to give actual percentages because people, you know, I just had a friend text me today and say, like, you know, my client's doctor told her she has a very high chance of uterine rupture because she conceived before what, the 12-month cutoff. Yeah. And I'm like, can you ask her to ask him what is very high chance and give her the statistic and the study? It's that kind of like you were saying earlier, the doctor just assumed, right? So they're just taught these things to do because most people just like me when I was my first, naive and like, okay, well, they're doctors. They know, like, I'll just go with what they want to do, right?
Yeah.
They just assumed that you would willingly succumb to what they wanted to do. So with uterine rupture with spontaneous labors, and this is a study Landon done in 2004, with spontaneous labors in that study, it was a 0.7% chance of uterine rupture.
It
went up to 1% with induced or augmented labors. Okay. And in a lot of the studies that you find, a lot of the women are either induced or augmented. And so that's why the results come out at 1% or 1.5%, which is usually what a doctor will tell you. And they'll say, like, that's a really high chance. I'm like, well, you know, it's a 99% chance you won't.
Yeah, I was going to say, in your mind, everyone's mind, but it's less than 5%. Let's go, doc. You know, what are you doing?
Yeah. And then, of that small chance, all uterine ruptures are not the same. And so the study also showed that, like, of that 0.7% uterine rupture risk, the risk of, like, baby dying, which is what they often will tell women, you have a high risk of baby dying, right? Like, you're risking your baby's death if you want to have a C-section.
So right away, you're like, okay.
So, but what they don't tell you are these numbers. And so, like, of that 0.7%, in that study in 2004, the risk of the baby dying was between 0.02% and 0.04%. And that's a pretty low absolute risk.
I'd say, like, very low, yeah.
So you've got to weigh, I always tell my clients and people, you need to weigh the risks of, you know, whatever treatment plan or whatever you're doing versus your risk of, like, staying pregnant, right? Or, like, you have to find out what those actual risks are and choose, because all birth has risk. It's a major physiological event. Things can go wrong, but oftentimes they don't when birth is left to do its thing. I believe that birth almost is more dangerous as soon as you start meddling. And in the medicalized model, they don't really know how to sit on their hands and let birth do its thing.
Yeah.
Physiological birth is very hard to attain in a hospital setting when, if your body's not moving along at the speed they want it to move along at, they're going to start doing things. And as soon as you start doing things, you're adding risk to your birth. So, like, I feel like it gets more dangerous as soon as you start doing things. And, like, augmenting. And
I agree, because it's like the birthing process, it's different for everybody, but you don't rush it, right? It's Mother Nature. You can't meddle and say, okay, we're going to speed this up. It's like, no, it's going to take its time. To talk about, like, how hard it can be for women to find a VBAC, you know, supportive provider, or even like a doula, because I didn't know what a doula even was until I met Grant and Nicole. So talk a little bit about that. And, you know, you started some online courses and you know, talk a little bit about all that.
So with our C-section rate being what it is in the States, it's like 30-33% now, depending where you're at.
Whoa. Getting close to 50.
Right. Well, in some Brazil, like, they're 50% above. Like, there are some places in the world where it's higher even. You know, back in the 70s, it was 5%. And then fetal heart rate monitoring, which is those straps that they put on your belly, right?
Yeah.
That came out in the 70s, continuous, like, while you're in labor. I don't know if your wife, you said your wife, it happened pretty fast, so maybe she didn't have those during labor.
Were they like, so like, I just picture they're pink and blue.
Yeah.
And, you know, you hear the heartbeat.
Listen to the heartbeat.
Yeah, listen to the heartbeat. Yeah.
Yeah. So continuous. So that was actually developed to prevent cerebral palsy, which it didn't do. Because cerebral palsy, like, it's been shown to, like, have the reason for it is often, like, prenatal factors, right? It didn't really prevent cerebral palsy. All it did was increase our C-section rate in our country, because That came out in the 70s. And so the C-section rate rose from 5% to 15.2% in 8 years.
Wow.
In 1978, it rose 3 times what it was in the 70s. And that's when fetal heart rate monitoring was just everywhere. And it's what I was talking about with my first birth. You know, they're like, well, baby's heart rate isn't doing great. You know, we're stressing it out. You know, maybe the reason you're stressing it out is all the Pitocin.
Yeah, and, right.
You know, a big reason for what I'm doing is just teaching people like how. Now, I haven't had a VBAC myself, right? So I'm not here to like teach women how to have a VBAC because I got mine. Do what I do and you'll get one. Because I don't believe that's possible, really. Everyone's situation is different. And where they feel comfortable birthing is different. A lot of my VBAC moms don't feel comfortable having home births. And that's fine. They just need to know what they're up against in a medicalized hospital setting and be prepared and have their spouses or, you know, partners be prepared as well, because they're going to have to do some heavy advocating. VBAC is a fight from preconception through the moment your baby's born. And not everyone's up for that either. And that's fine. If someone chooses to have a planned C-section, that's totally fine. I love supporting that as well, teaching women how to advocate for things that make planned C-sections more enjoyable as they can be. If people don't really know what a doula is, so we're essentially like labor coaches. So in pregnancy, I love working with women earlier in pregnancy. The sooner I can get them, the more beneficial a doula can be, right? Okay. So we're helping educate you on birth, steering you towards actually beneficial childbirth education classes, not the ones your hospital teaches.
Yeah, yeah.
Those ones just teach you how to be a good patient. They teach you how to consent to what they want to do.
Yeah, bend to their will. Yeah.
This is why we would want to do this. So if we tell you you need this, you need it. You should
just say yes. Right? Yeah, yeah.
So, and we like coach you on like, yeah, physical stuff. And then in the birth, we're there supporting both the mother and the partner physically, because it's exhausting supporting someone for 38 hours. I supported one of my clients in the hospital. I was up for 34 hours with them. And wow. You know, it was exhausting for her husband. It was exhausting for me. I could have slept for a day after.
Yeah, oh, I bet.
But
yeah.
We're there to like trade off and do counter pressure. And, you know, I bring my heat pads. And so
there's
a lot of things doulas do during your birth. But a lot of it is like your prenatal education and preparedness for birth. So physiological birth. Maybe you've heard about it, maybe you haven't, but a lot of doulas like to talk about it because we love it. I love home birth and, you know, I haven't had one yet, cross my fingers. But just once you start learning about how the birth process works and how, you know, a woman's body works, the more amazing it is. And the more you realize like, oh, the majority of birth like actually happens smoothly. And in the instances it doesn't, like, if you have a trained, experienced midwife on your back, they can help you with that, right? But oftentimes, if you just let it alone, things will usually go pretty smoothly. So our induction rate is insanely high, and like 1 in 10 of them are electively inducing. And I think women need to know, and their partners need to know, that as induction oftentimes leads to that cascade of interventions. And especially for first-time moms, as soon as you induce, your chance of C-section increases by 50%.
Wow.
Yeah, in the 1990s, it was only 9.6% of births were induced. And now it's, what, 37.8% of first-time moms are induced. Moms. Now, and that was in 2018. That was a study in 2018. So now I'd say it's likely 40% of first-time moms are induced.
Yeah.
They find some reason or other as you near your due date. Oh, baby's getting big. I don't know, your blood pressure's a little high, or like you're past your due date. It's like the biggest one.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, so physiological birth, I think of Beckett's death scene in Pirates of the Caribbean at World's End. Do you know his death scene where their ship is being blown at from both sides? Or his ship is from...
okay.
Yeah, Orlando Bloom, what's his name?
Yeah, William Turner.
Yeah.
William Turner.
They're Jack blasting Sparrow. A ship from both sides, right?
Yeah.
And it's just exploding, and he realizes, like, I'm going to die. He's like, okay, I'm going to die on this ship. So the scene is, it's on Instagram a lot. It's the scene of him walking peacefully through his ship that's just exploding everywhere around him.
Yep, yep.
That's kind of how I think of like trying to stick to a physiological birth plan in a hospital setting. You have all this like just stuff going on around you. They're trying trying to blow it up whirling, and you're just like... Anyways, so
I'm with you.
I don't think it's 100% possible, but it's a lot easier with a doula. So like if you're going to have a hospital birth, having the support of someone who knows more about birth than your partner,
which is
most partners don't know much.
Correct.
So having someone there who knows that, and then also someone who can help you gather the information you need to make actual informed consent decisions, right? So like in your situation, when the doctor wanted to insert a balloon, like way to go for you for sticking up and saying no a second time when most people would just probably lay on their back and be like, oh, okay, if you think so, right?
Whatever you think,
like,
doctor.
In that situation, it'd probably be like, okay, well, like, why do you need to do it right now? Like,
yes.
What are the risks?
Like, what's the rush? Yeah, why are we rushing, doc?
So, so doulas can help a lot with that.
Like you said, guys, we don't know, especially first time, and the moms don't know, the moms-to-be. It's kind of like you're just in uncharted waters, right? To stick with the Pirates of the Caribbean theme, and there is so much going on. You know, you have monitors on. Things are beeping. You know, what's going on? Blood pressure, is it high? Is it low? How's the baby? You know, the room next door, maybe in labor, and they're screaming, which, you know, and it's just so much going on. At the same time, you're trying to concentrate on
coping through the waves, like just getting to the next one, where a nurse is coming in asking, like, oh, do you want that pain medication?
Yeah.
Even when on your birth plan, you said you don't want to be offered pain medication.
Yeah, right.
They come in and offer it like candy, right?
Yes. Anyways. Or you're trying to sleep at night when you have a little bit of time and they keep coming in, like right when you fall asleep.
Yeah.
I don't know how you do that, nurses, but we love you.
Yeah,
you
we know? Do. We there, do. There yeah. are, I've come across some really great labor nurses. And oftentimes, like with my first, I just assumed, you know, we'll have a nurse with us, right?
Yeah.
I didn't know that, like, they have so many patients, right? So they're out in their, like, ward, their desk, right? Monitoring. Yeah. They're watching all the little heart rate monitors of all the rooms, right? So, like, they're not in there like a doula is, like, doing counter pressure, helping you focus mentally and making sure you stay hydrated. You know, they're just going to hook you up to an IV because they don't have the manpower. They can't stay by your side 100% of the time. So,
That's why a doula is so important.
Hire a dedicated labor coach.
Exactly.
Yeah. So then with VBAC, it's really, it's just really unfair. You know, as soon as a woman has a C-section, it's a big question of like, well, how many kids do you want? And it's like, well, I don't know. I was thinking I'd take it a kid at a time, right?
Yeah,
like,
you can't predict the future.
But
you know,
the thing with C-sections is like the more that you have, one, the more dangerous the surgery becomes, and two, the higher your risk for like complications in future pregnancies. So every C-section you have increases your risk of having something called placenta accreta. I didn't know about this until I had my second C-section. Okay. And I thought I was educated after my first.
Right.
So, and even on my consent forms from my OB office, it just said, you know, there's a small increased risk of placental abnormalities in future pregnancies. So like when you're trying for a VBAC, they give you a consent form, right? Because they got to cover their butts. So they show you, here's all the risks of having a VBAC. And it's like, your baby could die, you could rupture, like all these things. And then here's the risks of a C-section. And it's like two bullet points. And it's like some bleeding, a long recovery, and maybe a slight increased chance of placenta. They don't even say placenta accreta, placental abnormalities.
Yeah.
What placenta accreta is in your next pregnancy. So after you've had a C-section, your following pregnancy, that your placenta abnormally attaches to your uterine wall, and sometimes it can even grow into your uterus or out of your uterus and attach to outside organs. Okay.
Whoa.
So it's a major complication. It requires another cesarean to get out, and oftentimes a full hysterectomy, because that placenta won't detach from the uterus. Right. So they have to take the whole uterus out. So the risks of that are, hysterectomy and death. Like, so with every C-section you have, your chance of having that in your next pregnancy increases. So that's kind of their sneaky way of asking, like, well, how many kids do you want to have? Because we really only recommend you having 3 C-sections. Wow. I know people who've had 5 or 6 C-sections, and it just depends. Like some women can have 5 or 6 C-sections and no complications. Some women have 1 and their next pregnancy, it's placenta accretus. Some women have 2. So it's sort of unfair right out of the gate. You're expected to predict how many kids you want to have. Right. So yeah. So a VBAC after 1 C-section is super crucial, because the more C-sections you have, the less support you're going to get. I've had 2 C-sections. There's 1 hospital in our area that I could go to have a VBAC after 2 C-sections.
Really?
But I feel like that would be if I had a unicorn pregnancy and a unicorn birth progression. If everything doesn't happen by the book, I know where it will lead, right?
Yeah.
So personally, I'm going with a home birth midwife because I know my risks. And I think a big thing people think is like that the risks could scare you, right? And I think for me, it's been a 5-year journey of learning the actual truth, learning the facts. And that actually has assuaded a lot of fears. My husband was dead set against home birth before even our first kid. With our second, he was still against home birth.
Okay.
He's now 100% on board and excited.
Shout out to Justin.
For a home birth with our third. He's amazing. And confident just because of what we learned. So I really think that can help, just learning that. And then also just how to find support. So it can be hard to find support because it's just, it's viewed differently by different practitioners. You know, if someone sees a bad uterine rupture, they might not want to allow more women to do VBACs because they've been traumatized. Like, yeah, it's a lot of birth workers, a lot of doctors are traumatized. I've seen hard things and it's taken me a bit. So that's just, it sucks for more women because it's taking away their right to autonomy, to choose how to birth their baby simply because the practitioner's not comfortable with it. Yeah. You know, like it can be hard for women to find a practitioner that's supportive. There's a lot of gray areas. Practitioners, and I learned this with my second, they can seem very supportive or they can seem supportive until you reach 38 weeks, 39 weeks, mm-hmm. 40 weeks. Then they start telling you, well, your chance of having a VBAC is so much lower now because you're past your due date. Yeah, newsflash, it's not, quote, so much lower. That's not a reason to have a C-section. So my C-section with my second was at 41 weeks and 2 days. And I was just so fear-mongered and so defeated and beaten down. And I just surrendered to it and didn't want it at all. And yeah, but my baby's beautiful. She's amazing.
Good.
Everything worked out. But it definitely set me on the journey of like, how can I help other women that are in my position 3 years ago when I was pregnant with my VBAC baby? Like, how can I help them build their confidence so that when they get to 38, 39, 40 weeks pregnant, they can face whatever practitioner they have? Because sometimes you're stuck with an unsupportive practitioner or a tolerant one. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you're just stuck with one. Maybe you can't afford a home birth midwife, but you know, I'd challenge, you know, how much money do you pay for your wedding? $6,000-$7,000 is pretty worth having a better experience.
Definitely.
You know, so, but yeah, sometimes you're stuck. So how can I help women build their confidence and their education so that they can feel confident in just facilitating good communication with their practitioners so that their practitioner can understand, okay, this woman knows her stuff and also like, you know, is making sure that the choice that she makes is actually beneficial for her and her baby's health and safety. And it's not just because she's past 40 weeks or just because it's easier or it fits in my schedule. Right. You know, I was told I couldn't, like there wasn't any room in the schedule for my C-section past Monday. So I had to have my mom Monday. Right. Like,
It's like, this is what's happening. It's like, oh, okay, great. Yeah. And I think too, having someone experienced like a doula, a birthing consultant, someone there in the room, because especially your first, but doctors, you know, they talk, I think it's just natural. It's just a habit. They talk kind of down to you, you know, obviously because they're the experts, right? You're supposed experts. Hopefully they are, you know, and they kind of make you feel like, you know, this is the only way. And
obstetricians, they're surgeons and their specialty is like when things go wrong in pregnancy, right? I don't believe that like 80% of first-time moms are like healthy, low risk, whatever. They should not be going to a surgeon for their prenatal care. Like, there's no reason. There was a study done on home birth that actually, now everyone is not, home birth isn't for everyone, right? Not everyone's comfortable with it. But there's a study published in The Lancet in 2020 that showed that women who book for a home birth, regardless of where they actually birthed. So let's say they booked a home birth. They had the individualized comprehensive care of a home birth midwife where your prenatal appointments are an hour long. They go over everything. Just a higher level of care, right? You're not having 7-minute face-to-face appointments once a month and then like with different OBs every time.
Yes.
Because you got to meet all the different ones because you don't know who's going to be there for your birth.
Exactly. Right? Yes. Yeah.
So yeah. Yep. When women had that home birth care, even if they had to transfer to a hospital because maybe they got had maternal exhaustion and they needed an epidural, like they transferred, regardless of where they actually birthed, they were 40% less likely to have a cesarean birth. They were 50% less likely to have an instrumental birth. They were 70% less likely to have an epidural. They were 55% less likely to have an episiotomy, 40% less likely to have a third or fourth degree tear, and 60% less likely to have their labor augmented using Pitocin. So like, doesn't that sound safer?
It does.
Like just yes. All around safer.
All around safer. So, yeah.
Yeah. Even if you're not like 100% on board with home birth, sitting down with a home birth midwife, interviewing them, getting to know them, how they manage certain emergent situations, like what their transfer protocol would be, it can really put you at ease. And maybe you could work something out if you're wanting to have a VBAC where you have a home birth midwife for prenatal care. You also have a plan set up with a hospital and an OB in case you do need to transfer or you want to transfer because you want an epidural at some point. You're already increasing your chance of a successful VBAC simply by doing that, rather than just going through the OB funnel where they're going to fearmonger you at every appointment and you'll leave in tears. So I just thought that was really interesting.
No, I'm glad you shared those facts. I mean, those statistics, because you never know if you can sway someone for a better experience, a birthing experience, you know, that makes it all worth it. Cause you're worried about your wife, you know, how is she going to get through this?
Yeah, it impacts your perspective on parenthood, like motherhood, parenthood. Yes. I know my husband was like in knots and nervous that I would fall into depression again after our second kid if I had another C-section. So he was always so like it impacts everything.
Definitely. He'll take a sip break. Like you're offering online courses. Like let's talk about if somebody wanted to reach out to you to be a doula, you know, how do they do that? What's the process like?
So I'm on Instagram, courageous.birth. That's where I'm at right now. I do have a program coming out in May here soon. It's called Courageous VBAC, Your Path to an Empowered and Informed Birth.
Okay.
Kind of like I was talking about earlier about how like some knowing the facts and the truth is empowering. And you need to, if you're wanting to have a VBAC, you need to go in with all the confidence and empowerment possible. And also know how to build a team around you that will empower you, right? And support you along the way. Personally, it's more than a course or a community or coaching program for me. It's like a comprehensive journey of self-discovery. It's really sort of my journey from the past 5 years. Because we start with your previous births, you know, fully processing those and even understanding why you had your C-section. I find a lot of women don't even understand why they had their first C-section, or they have a medicalized warped perspective of why, you know, like it's why the OB told them why they had their C-section.
Yeah, because the doctor said, said. Yeah.
So understanding that and then moving, you know, past fear into truth and facts and learning about VBAC and like, how to interview practitioners, how to find supportive practitioners, what questions to ask, what their answers mean and how that can impact your journey, how to find doulas in your area. I'm at courageous.birth. There are lots of doulas in the area. If you reach out to one doula and she's booked, ask her. She will spread it out and we have a whole little network.
Oh, nice. Okay.
And that's how actually one of my VBAC clients found me. She Someone texted the group I'm in. They were like, hey, VBAC mom, she's 39 weeks. Anyone free? And I was like, I'm free.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
I found her Saturday. We had a prenatal appointment on Saturday. Okay. She went into labor on Sunday.
Wow.
She hired me the day before.
Yeah. Power of social media, bringing people together.
Exactly.
Wow.
So, yeah. So it's more than that. It's, just helping moms come out of that, like, uncertainty and fear and, like, overwhelm of what it means to navigate having a VBAC and to step forward with confidence. And then also, be equipped with that truth and clarity, as well as personal support through, like, literally it's like virtual doula coaching from me in order to navigate your VBAC journey with courage. So it's called Courageous VBAC. There'll also be things on there for C-section moms. It's really more so, it's less like you have to have a VBAC, right? Because mm-hmm. then there's that subsection of moms who had a, quote, failed VBAC. You know, like maybe you tried for a VBAC and ended up in another cesarean. You can, like, that can be a heavy burden, right? So, like, I'm not of the mind that, like, everyone has to try for a VBAC. I'm of the mind of you need to know your risks and know the implications of more C-sections. And then also, like, if that's what you choose or if you're in the situation you need another C-section, this is what you can do to build a support system around you. This is what you can ask for during the C-section. This is how you can plan for it. Like, you're just as much a mother. You're just as valuable. You deserve just as much support having a C-section, if not more support, than having a successful VBAC. So if you're just curious about VBAC and you're maybe unsure, a little fearful of it, it's going to be pretty eye-opening and hopefully help assuage your fears. And also, I think the one time it really opened my eyes, I was talking with some 9-year-old.
Okay.
And I mentioned, it was right after I had helped a woman have her baby at home. And I was like, the midwife didn't make it in time. I actually, like, caught the baby.
Oh, wow.
And the girl looked at me and she was like, you have to have babies in the hospital. And this was this 9-year-old's perspective, which is fine. Like, they were probably all born at the hospital, right? Yeah. So that's what she knows. Yeah. She knows, like, all babies were born in the hospital. So, like, she said that. And I was like, well, actually, some women choose to have their babies at home. And it's an option, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
So I was just like, wow, a 9-year-old just said that. And then fast forward, I think 2 days later, my oldest daughter and I were talking about birth. Mm-hmm. And she just looked at me and she said, I want to have my babies at home. And I was like, no, melt my heart.
Yeah, yeah.
So just, like, knowing you have options and, not being, naive and knowing your power too, because a lot of that was taken away from women with Twilight Sleep in the 50s and just a lot of things and just, like, women taking their power back and knowing, and just having empowering births. And that can happen with an OB. It can be empowering for sure. You just have to advocate for yourself. So,
no, big time for sure. Some of the items you brought with today. Let's talk about those.
So I brought one of my houseplants. I couldn't haul in my 5-foot Monstera in here. So I just brought my small.
It's perfect. Yeah.
This is a Thai constellation Monstera. So the leaves, this new leaf just unfurled the other day and I'm obsessed. So this is one of, I don't buy a lot of really expensive houseplants. This is one of my more expensive houseplants.
Okay. Oh, some essential oils.
I brought an essential oil because I use them a lot in my doula bag. This one's actually clary sage. It can be used on the belly and feet and ankles to help support consistent contractions and even, like, induce contractions in labor. So us doulas sometimes use that in labor. I used it with one of my home birth clients and she had her baby an hour and a half later. There are other factors in that, but And then a little Marshall
Paw Patrol
toy. Okay. My 3-year-old is obsessed with Paw Patrol. She loves singing the Paw Patrol song.
Paw Patrol, be there on the double.
Yeah. And she'll go, Chase, Marshall, Rebel, Zoomia, Sky. I don't know.
You got them. Yeah, I think that's all of them. Yeah.
There's like 9 of them. T-Rex, Tracker.
Tracker. That's what I always mess up. He has the pointy ears.
My 3-year-old knows all of them and she is fully obsessed. So
that's Parker. Parker sort of. Likes
and the
Paw Patrol.
Essential oil also is like a nod to my hippie kind of crunchy days back in living in Washington. I was even more sort of a hippie than I am now. Yeah, free spirited. So I still am, but
I love it. Oh, very cool. No, those are great items. just again, real quick to reiterate, how can our listeners connect with you and follow along on your journey?
Yeah. Yeah. Instagram at courageous.birth. And then as my course launches here, it'll be Courageous VBAC. So courageousvbac.com. And that'll be a link to my course. It's a 10-week course. It's good for anyone who's maybe due with their VBAC baby after August.
Okay.
So the course will run through July. So if you're due August or later with your VBAC baby, or even, you know, maybe you're not pregnant yet, it would still be really helpful. So yeah, you can find me there on Instagram and at courageousvbac.com.
Perfect. And before we close out, is there anything else you'd like the listeners to know?
Yeah. Partners out there, just know that, you know, there's motherly intuition, and trust your partner. She knows what's going on with her body. As much as we lean on the medical system and doctors to tell us what to do, I think it's important for moms to remember, and their partners to remember, to also trust their intuition. And if something isn't sitting quite right, to reach out for help. And yeah, thank you for having me.
Gloria Lapp, a certified birth doula on the American Grown podcast in the ColorTech Creative Solutions Studios. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you.
If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and leave a review. To see photos of today's guests and more content, just search American Grown Podcast on Facebook and Instagram.
If you'd like to be a featured guest on the podcast, please direct message or email Austin at AmericanGrownPod@gmail.com.
This episode was brought to you by these sponsors.
Cleona Coffee Roasters is a small batch coffee roastery and coffee shop, veteran and first responder owned, community oriented, and roasted fresh to order. Now open inside 911 Rapid Response, Anvil, PA. Go to CleonaCoffeeRoasters.com to order online, see updated hours, and find where you can buy it close to you.
Triggered 22 LLC, a veteran owned apparel company. By purchasing a t-shirt, hat, or hoodie from Triggered 22, you're not only supporting a small business, but you're bringing awareness to veteran PTSD and suicide. Please help save the lives of those who fought for our freedoms. Visit triggered22.com now and place your order. Let's help those suffering from invisible wounds.